This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Gordon Lafer, a political economist at the University of Oregon. He has been investigating the financial impact of charter schools on the funding of public education. In the public interest, a research and policy center committed to promoting the common good and democratic control of public goods and services, recently published two reports about his findings. Today's conversation will focus particularly on the expansion of charter schools in three school districts in California, and the way this expansion is constraining the capacity of district-run schools to best serve their students. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what's unique about your investigation of charter schools?
It's been a very kind of in the weeds, granular investigation. The report we most recently published is the first of its kind that looks in the current year at adding up all the actual numbers from three representative school districts in California to figure out what the net fiscal impact of charter school expansion has been in those three districts.
So why are your findings about the financial impact of charter schools so critical for public education at this time?
Well, you know, charter school laws vary a lot by state, but in many parts of the country, what's being pushed is a kind of unlimited expansion of charter schools. And when charter schools expand, they impose a net fiscal cost on public school districts, which means, in concrete terms, cuts in services to the vast majority of students who remain in traditional public schools and public school districts. And that's something that, you know, there are a handful of studies that have tried to measure this over the past decade in different parts of the country, but I think has become a growing issue of growing urgency for teachers, for students, for parents, for elected school board officials, because as charter schools grow, this fiscal impact has gotten more and more severe. And that's certainly the case in California, where charter schools now account for about 10% of the total student population.
Is the expansion of charter schools similar in other states?
So it really varies state by state in terms of how many charter schools there can be. In some states, there's a cap on the number of charters. The authorization process varies from state to state. California has one of the most unregulated charter school industries where there's no cap. There can be no cap. Charter schools can apply to a school district, but if rejected, can appeal to the county and then to the state. And by the time they get to the state, as long as a charter school is obeying all the laws and, you know, it's kind of has competent management, the only two reasons that the state is allowed to reject a charter application to open a new school is either if the school has evidence that it will actually harm the students or that it will provide no educational benefit whatsoever, meaning not compared to the next best school, but compared to staying home and doing nothing all year. So in reality, you know, the idea of charter schools in California and elsewhere, if you read the original enabling legislation, was to launch, you know, what often got called a research and development wing of the school system, a place where there would be novel experiments, where small groups of parents or teachers or innovative educators would launch experiments that the rest of the school system could learn from. But that wasn't written into law. And so what we have instead is a system where anybody who just meets, you know, the basic minimum of legal and managerial compliance can open a school. It doesn't have to offer anything that's not already being offered by local public schools. It doesn't have to do anything new. It doesn't have to be innovative. It doesn't have to show that it's a high educational quality. And all of them are approved. And that creates something that nobody really envisioned when they created charter schools. So this varies state by state, but it's like this in a large number of states. And of course, California is the biggest charter school industry and a place where a lot of the national chains kind of grow up and then expand to the rest of the country.
So would it be fair to say that you're not opposed to charter schools per se in terms of their potential as sites of innovation and creativity? The real problem is the unregulated expansion that we're encountering, at least in some states.
That's right. I mean, none of my research and none of in the public interest research is opposed to charter schools per se. And, you know, among people who work in or for or have their kids in charter schools, there are many different visions. I think there are, you know, there are a lot of people who think that the original vision of charter schools was good. We should use these as sites of innovation and experimentation. But there, unfortunately, there are also some people, either for ideological or business reasons, who are really pushing for unlimited expansion of charter school, regardless of quality, in an attempt to ultimately to kind of crash the public school system. But our report is not pro or anti either any particular charter school or the general idea of charter schools. It's really just saying we need to take account of what the fiscal cost is and not pretend that this is costless. You could say, yeah, it costs a lot, but it's worth it in some cases. But you can't pretend that there's no cost, and that that cost should be something that elected school officials can take into account when deciding how many charter schools are appropriate for their community.
So you focused on three districts in California, San Diego, Oakland, and Santa Clara County, the home of Silicon Valley. Why, and how would you describe the similarities and differences among these districts?
So, you know, these are districts, I will not say that they're statistically representative, because that wasn't possible. They're Oakland and San Diego are two of the largest districts. Oakland is the poorest district and also the district that has the highest percentage of students being educated in charter schools, almost 30%. But they vary both in their size and the percentage of charter schools in them, in their demographic population. And we thought it was important to look at three different districts in different part of the states, but that all three have significant percentage of students in charter schools, and to gauge what the impact is in each of these places. And of course, it's different in each place, partly because under California law, the school funding formula, the funding per student is different in each place, but they come out ballpark to a similar, to show similar results. And both in terms of the cost per student of charter school expansion, and those results are also ballpark similar to results that other scholars have found in studies in other parts of the country.
So how much revenue have these districts been losing as a result of charter schools?
Well, you know, the important thing that we measure is not total revenue loss, but is the net fiscal impact.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to explain this for a minute, because, you know, this is really the crux of the whole issue. School funding is discussed on a per pupil basis. And it turns out that that's a bit misleading once you have something like charter schools, because when people hear, oh, per pupil funding is $9,000 per pupil or something, they think that that's just the cost of educating one student. But so what happens is when a student moves from a public school to a charter school, let's say they're in a district where funding is $10,000 per student, the entire per pupil funding is taken out of the public school district and given to the charter school. But that $10,000 is not just the cost of educating that student. It's also the per student share of all of the overall costs of the district, the cost of having buildings, the cost of having snowplows, the cost of having electricity, the cost of having a department that plans the bus routes, a department that certifies which kids are eligible for free and reduced meals, department that does planning. All of those costs are, you know, a prorated share of those costs are also cut. So roughly, you know, what most people find is that when a student leaves, the amount of cost that can be reduced in a district is only about half of the amount that's associated with that student. So if, let's say, a student leaves, the district loses $10,000, but they only save $5,000 by having to educate one student less. And the other costs, you know, a lot of those costs that can't be cut, right? If, obviously, if one student leaves, there's very few costs that can be cut. But even if you have a school that loses 50 students, but they're spread across 5 or 10 different grades, and so it's only a few students per grade, they may or may not even be able to cut a single teacher. If they can cut a single teacher, okay, they can't lay off their principal, they can't lay off their custodian, they can't cut the size of their heating bill or of their school cafeteria. And because those things can't be cut, other things have to be cut. And what the other things are things that are more discretionary. The class teachers get laid off and class sizes grow. You cut laboratory science. You cut nurses. You cut school counselors and social workers. You cut field trips. And so what we see is that the remaining money that is not really saved when a student leaves gets cut out of services to the remaining students. And that's what we measure, not the total revenue loss, but the net loss, the amount of revenue that's lost and that is not made up for by having to educate fewer students. Our estimate is that in Oakland, every year, the district suffers a net loss of $57 million by virtue of the size of the charter school industry in that district. In San Diego, the number is $65 million. And in Eastside Union High School District, which is a smaller high school district within Santa Clara County, within San Jose, is $19 million a year. That's every year. That's the net loss, which basically translates into cuts in services for the remaining students.
And those net losses are really kind of tied into the enrollment declines that you've seen as students have moved from the district-run schools to the charters. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. That's what it comes from.
Now, could those enrollment declines somehow be linked to any other factors over and beyond charters? Because in many U.S. large U.S. cities, there's been an out-migration of families over the past 25 years, and I've just kind of wondered whether that might have been a contributing factor to the decline in student enrollments that you've seen in these three districts.
So it's a really good point, and it's a common point that is raised. There are a number of districts that have seen overall declining school-age population. We have data, I think almost every place, certainly in these districts and in California, that separates out how much is happening, you know, how much is enrollment declining, let's say in Oakland, because of an overall decline in school age population, and how much is it declining because of charter schools. So you can separate out those two effects. That's pretty easy to do, and our study does that. But on top of that, there are people who ask a question saying, okay, in a school district like Los Angeles, where the overall population of school age children is declining significantly, the school district needs to figure out how to do, you know, what to do about that. And the same way they need to figure out what to do about that, they need to figure out what to do about kids going to charter schools. It's not really any different from dealing with general population decline. Mm-hmm. And that's partly right, but mostly wrong. The partly right part is it is a fiscal problem for districts that lose student, you know, that have declining student populations. They also have a problem of losing more money than they save and having to make painful cuts. So that part is true, but there are things that are unique about losing students to charter schools that make the problem worse. So one is that because, let's say in a state like California, charter schools can open and really cannot be denied. They certainly can't be denied on the basis of fiscal crisis in the host school district. Charter schools make it impossible for school districts to control the number of schools in their community. So if you have declining student population, the normal thing that a school district would do is look for opportunities to close a couple of schools and consolidate schools. But they know that as soon as they close a school, there's nothing to prevent a charter operator from opening a new school in the same location that they just closed. And there are school districts in places around the country that have said, we're operating the school at a loss. We know we're losing money on it. We would like to close it. But we believe that if we close it, a charter operator will open a school in that same place and will lose even more money that way than we are this way. So they lose the ability to do the most basic things, you know, one of the most basic things that school boards are charged with, which is saying, how many schools should there be for the population we have? So that's one way that charter schools, the loss of students to charter schools is different from simply a loss due to population. So another couple of things that are unique, right? One is that charter schools themselves are often volatile enterprises. There are more than 400 charter schools that have closed in California in the last two decades. And public school districts, when a charter school closes, public school districts are responsible for taking those kids in, which means they need to maintain a certain cushion to be able to absorb those students. There are other things as well that make the loss to charter schools a different kind of thing. But I would say the single most important thing is that from a rational policy planning point of view, if you're in a district that has overall falling student population, the last thing you would normally do is say, let's open more schools. But that's what is forced by the charter school law in a place like California that says explicitly that falling student population or economic fiscal crisis in the district is not an acceptable reason for not approving more charter schools. So, you know, normally if there were no charter schools and you had a public school district that had falling enrollment and the district said, you know what, we're going to create a system within the district where anybody who wants can open a new school. And it doesn't have to be coordinated in any way with the enrollment patterns or the geographic patterns or the school specializations of already existing schools. That would be the poster child for government waste. But that is what the law mandates in a state like California, where there's really no check on the number or kind of charter schools that have to be approved.
Now, is a similar situation found in other states as well, where districts are prevented from using fiscal considerations in their decisions about opening new charter schools?
Yes, in most states, although the authorization laws vary state by state, there is no state that says explicitly that authorizers can take into account the fiscal impact on school districts. And in fact, even recognizing the fiscal impact on school districts is a relatively new thing. The recommendations in this report are only two. There's no recommendations about exactly how many charter schools there should be or what the criteria should be for approving them. I think that belongs in the hands of California school boards. Our recommendations are, first, that we should count this, that we should measure it, and that every school district should do an economic impact, measuring the fiscal impact of charter schools in their own community. And we've actually created an online template to enable school districts to do that. And the second thing is that school districts, and at the level both of the district, the county, and the state, should be allowed to take this into account as a reason for deciding to allow or not allow the further growth of charter schools.
Now, one of the things that has confused me about this analysis is that I know that in Oregon, the amount that each student is able to bring with them to a charter school is pretty significantly prorated, something that can have a major impact on the ability of charter schools to meet their own expenses. I've been told by a charter school principal in Portland that it's about 55% of the normal per pupil allocation. So why is it that the remaining 45% is not enough to cover the additional expenses that you've enumerated?
Well, I think we're talking about two different state laws. Okay. I mean, my study was in California. In California,
right.
100% of the funding follows the student to the,
really?
To the charter school.
Wow.
So I think that what you're talking about is Oregon law, that would be enough, or something like that would be enough to kind of hold harmless or make whole the public school district. But of course, just as you say, then it creates a fiscal problem for charter schools, at least assuming that they're brick and mortar schools. I mean, one of the challenges in many parts of the country is 100% of the funding in many states, including California, goes even to virtual schools whose costs are of course much, much less. But in any case, I think we're talking about the same reality, just a different law between Oregon and California.
Right. And as far as you know, is it common for other states to basically let 100% of the dollars follow students as they migrate to the charter schools?
It is common. I think it's more common than the law in Oregon. And, you know, I've seen studies estimating fiscal impact similar, you know, kind of ballpark similar to what we found in California, in New York State, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania, and in Michigan. So our study really just looked at California, and I have not done a 50-state comprehensive review, but I know that this is a problem that exists in many other states.
Uh-huh. Now, which students in particular are especially harmed by the loss of these revenues to the districts?
Well, I think there are cuts that affect all students, but, you know, unsurprisingly, one of the things that we see is that charter schools cream the eligible population in many ways, some easy to capture in data and some harder to capture in data. But to give you some of the ones that are easy to capture in data, special education, this is a problem, I think, around the country. In California, special education funding is per student. It's not even per special needs student. It's just per overall student. It's the funding works on the assumption that special needs students are essentially evenly distributed across all schools. But that's not true. So in Oakland, for instance, when we looked at a year when 28% of all students were in charter schools. So 28% of the special needs, special education funding went to charter schools. But they only served 19% of the special needs students. So they're getting more money than the percentage of students that they need. And when you break it down by the 13 categories of need within special needs students that the U.S. Department of Education maintains, what you see is that charter schools on average not only serve a significantly smaller share of special needs students, but they serve the students with more mild needs. They're more likely to serve kids with dyslexia or ADD and not kids with traumatic brain injury or autism or other things that are harder and more expensive to serve. So the result of that is that the students with the most expensive needs and the most, you know, not just expensive, but in human terms, the most pressing needs, the most serious needs are left in a system that doesn't have the resources to serve them. The same is true of many other things, right? This is one of the differences of the public school system and charter schools is that public schools need to serve everybody. So for instance, unaccompanied minors crossing the border into the country. Oakland is the number two destination of those kids after Los Angeles. They receive about 1,000 students a year during the course of the school year. Charter schools are not obligated to take these students in, but public schools are. Because they come in all through the school year, and it actually peaks in December and January, which some people think is because the desert is cooler then, the district has to overstaff its schools from the beginning of the year, anticipating having 1,000 of these kids coming in during the course of the school year, but they only, under the school funding formula, they only get funded for those students from the moment that they show up, which means student shows up in January, you're funding half the year on a deficit basis. So this gets very, very detailed, very technical, but this is one of multiple ways in which the neediest students have to be taken in by the public schools, do not have to be taken in by the charter schools. And so the neediest students end up in the place that is missing out on resources. And that's true by poverty. It's true by kids with, asthma and type 1 diabetes. And these are some of the needs that are going unfunded or underfunded.
Now, earlier you mentioned some of the political motivations that might lie behind the creation of more charter schools. Could you say more about that?
Well, I have been in conversation, for instance, with the California Charter School Association, which is a charter promotion and booster organization. And I was kind of surprised. In the first report that we did, which came out in 2016, it was a report called Spending Blind that looked just at spending on facilities, on charter school building, construction, lease, or rent. And we found hundreds of millions of dollars wasted. And one of the things that we looked at is we looked at schools, how charter schools compared by their educational performance to nearby public schools. To say, when charter schools opening, is it offering a better quality of education than what's already available in the nearby public schools? And obviously, test scores are not necessarily the thing that really captures quality of education, but it tends to be what we have in policy discussions. So we looked at test scores of charter schools and compared them with nearby public schools that served a demographically similar population of students. And we found that 3/4 of charter schools did not provide a superior education to a similar population of students. But we looked also at the Charter Schools Association own numbers that in 2015-16 in California compared all charter schools to what they said were their peer institutions that served a demographically similar population of students. They identified 161 charter schools that they said were among the worst of the worst, were in the bottom 10% of performing schools compared to other schools in the state that serve similar student population. So I said to them, I said, okay, I understand, reasonable people can differ on where the line should be, but shouldn't there be some line that says, we only want to put money into schools that meet some standard, they provide something new, or they meet some educational standard? And their position is no. Any charter school is good, no matter what its educational track record is. And that, to me, is robbing students. I think that is not what most charter school parents think. That is not what a lot of good, innovative people running charter schools think. But it is what a lot of the moneyed interests and the lobbyists on this issue apparently are proposing. And I was surprised by that.
Since it seems unlikely that charters are going to go away anytime soon, are there ways you could imagine districts and charter schools collaborating to diminish the negative effects their expansion is having on the education of children in district-run schools?
Well, I think that there is to me a dangerous idea that I have seen promoted by some of the charter school promoting people like the Center for Reinventing Public Education. That's a Gates Foundation funded advocacy group in Washington State that say things kind of like what you said. Well, the district and charter schools should get together and have some kind of joint oversight or something like that. I think it, and I say this as somebody who not only doesn't think charter schools are going to go away, but doesn't think they should go away, that we just have to have sensible regulations of this. We have a democratically elected body, and that is the school board. So in the things that I have seen coming out of the Gates-funded people seem to say, let's have a partnership between the democratically elected people who the voters said we want to oversee the school system in our community and a group of entrepreneurs who are completely democratically unaccountable, and they'll each have, 50% say over what happens with public resources. I don't think that's right. I think we elect school boards, we elect state school, school superintendents, and they're elected for a reason, that those are the people, the democratically elected people, who should devise a system in which we say charter schools should be part of the system, and they should play the kind of role that everybody agrees they should play, and that is in all the legislative history of all the laws, I think in almost every state, had this idea of an experimental sector. And that's what they should be. But this shouldn't be a way to privatize something. It shouldn't be something that gets done to the detriment of public school students. It shouldn't be something that takes over and replaces the public school system. So I think there are a lot of ways, and I think that, it seems like California will be seeing some of these ways, that I think a lot of people have gotten alarmed as the charter school industry has grown to be much bigger than anybody envisioned. And some of these things like fiscal impacts have become more apparent. I think it, certainly in California, but in other parts of the country too, there are movements to figure out a sensible way to regulate this and to have real filters that say, okay, what we want is schools that offer something new, different, or better than what is otherwise available in the public school system. But we don't just want an endless number of repetitive, unremarkable schools being funded. And I guess, the other thing I would say is that when you have a law like California's, what you end up with is more schools per capita than you would otherwise. And this came out in research of Detroit as well, that you end up having, because you have no cap on the number of schools, and any entrepreneur who is competent can open a school and get government guaranteed funding, you end up with more money proportionally being put into buildings and administrators and less into students and teachers because you have too many schools for the number of students. And that's something that publicly elected officials should be able to have control over. It's one of the most fundamental responsibilities of a community school board is to say, how many schools do we need for the number of kids? Can we maximize the ability of students to attend local neighborhood schools? Can we make sure that there's a tech school and a language immersion school and a Montessori school for the kids in our community? That's a central responsibility of a centrally elected body that I think has to be carried out by the democratically elected board.
Well, many thanks, Gordon, for helping us better understand the way charter school expansion is affecting the ability of communities to best use their limited educational resources. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. November's Education Interview of the Month will be with Dr. Rick Mintrup, the director of the Doctoral Program in Leadership for Educational Equity at UC Berkeley. He and a group of Chilean colleagues have recently published a policy brief on their investigation of the universal implementation of school vouchers and privatization in Chile. Their findings have much to say about what might happen in the United States if similar policies were to become more widespread here. We invite you to join us again for another podcast.